Okay, we had up to this point in time been dealing with events leading up to the Reformation, and then last Sunday we got to talking about the actual Reformation and the people involved in the period called Reformation, historically speaking. Happened in the 1500s, and we talked discussed a couple of the forerunners of that, Tyndale and a fellow named Huss, and then discussed Luther himself. Which is, I think most people rightly associate Luther with the person who is the pivotal person as far as the beginning of the Reformation. That was dealing with the German Reformation according to the German tradition. And now we're into Switzerland and this fellow Zwingli. And we discussed Zwingli and talked about his some of the events that took place while he was there and living, including, I think we finished off with a list of things that he set forth as far as his teaching was concerned, and that is the idea of just, and these are things that are similar to what we've heard with Luther, although not exactly the same, justification by faith. He condemned, of course, the Catholic doctrines of Mass and invoking the saints, and said that the clergy ought to marry, and church services should be in the language of the people, and do away with the monastic orders, and got rid of the idols in the church building, got rid of the organ, got rid of the music, instrumental music, and went back to repudiated transubstantiation, and went back to the Lord's Supper being a memorial. These things came about in a debate form, and he had talked to the city council and let them, and they took the charge to be the judges of who won the debate. Well, they judged he won the debates that he had, and they went on, made a further pronouncement, that is, gave him the authority to make whatever changes he deemed appropriate according to Scripture in the churches. And so he basically became dictator of the city of Zurich in his life. And he used the Bible, he viewed the Bible as his rule book as he went about making these changes. And his view, contrasted with Luther's view, was that all you could do in your religious service was what was stated in the Bible. Luther's approach was you could do anything that wasn't forbidden in the Bible. So you had these two counter views of authority. And as the Reformation was just getting off the ground, the Catholic Church, of course, was still persecuting them and was on the verge of really winning, if you think of it in that kind of a battle term. And so, come on in. Somewhere there's a seat. Did you ever get a book?
What you sell man, you keep a book, keep coming. One lesson as well.
Wally, so we have Lutherans, well, we have Zwinglians.
Because you have, good question. Luther didn't want to have a church named after him.
Right.
And that's just what took place. He died, as he was getting this thing off the ground. And it ended up being called the Lutheran Church. Mm-hmm. And in Zwingli's case, it became the Swiss Reformed Church. And so it wasn't, had Luther lived and had his way, I don't know whether they would call it, but it wouldn't have been a Lutheran church, that's for sure.
So is there a Swiss Reformed church today?
Yes.
Huh.
There is. And remember, we're still in Europe. We're finally going to get to America, believe it or not, sooner or later. But we're still in Europe right now, and there is. There's a very, I think about a third of the population of Switzerland are members of the Swiss Reformed church. So anyway, you had this. You had the Protestants were the Catholics were still persecuting the Protestants, and so Zwingli and Luther decided to join forces, or their followers did. And so they sent representatives. Each of these men sent representatives to meet and see if they could agree. And they agreed on there were 15 items that Luther said were necessary for them to agree upon to be able to work together. And they agreed on 14 of them, and one of them they didn't agree on. And so he and Zwingli met. And the one thing they didn't agree on was the Lord's Supper. Luther took the position that took the consubstantiation position, and Zwingli took the position that the Lord's Supper was a memorial. And one of the things that was interesting about this, I think, in terms of how it played out, is in the course of the discussions, Luther made the evidently took chalk, wrote on a board that Jesus said, "This is my body." So he wrote, "This is my body." And he said, "This is what Jesus meant." This insisting that Jesus meant just what he said. So when you read something, you've heard that before? You read something in the Bible? Does it mean what it says? Or does it mean what it means? And so Zwingli's comeback on that was, no, when Christ said that this is my body, his flesh was unbroken, and he didn't in any way, shape, or form convert the bread as they were meeting for the Passover into flesh. That was one argument. Another argument he made is Jesus said this cup is my blood, and then he later would say, as he talked about it, that he would not drink it again, drink this fruit of the vine. So he called it blood, but later on, same gathering, he calls it fruit of the vine, proving that he didn't change it to blood. That was his argument. But it didn't convince Luther, and he and Luther could not agree, and Luther, in essence, withdrew from him. He would not have fellowship with him. So they moved on their separate ways. And it wasn't long after this, John Calvin comes on the scene, and Zwingli's followers end up hooking up with those that followed the teaching of Calvin. And so you don't really have you have Calvinists, but you don't have Zwinglites either in the course of history. So that was the beginning of the Swiss Reformation. In Switzerland, you have another person that you cannot escape noticing, and that's John Calvin. And Calvin comes on the scene in the 1500s as well. Of course, we just had three months of Calvinism, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on him, just sort of a refresher. Since we know, talking about Calvinism, his theology, is the term that will be applied to the churches that would generally follow Calvinistic theology in Europe would be called Reformed churches. So you have the Swiss Reformed Church in Switzerland. You have other Reformed churches as well. The other thing that came out of, would come out of Calvin's efforts would be the Presbyterian churches. And we'll talk about that when we get to that point. Calvin was, like a lot of these guys, was an educated man, went to the University of Paris. In his case, he actually studied theology and theology and logic and law. And then he went, as we've seen with a number of these guys, he studied the humanities and ended up studying Greek, Hebrew, and Latin classics. And when he was 27 years old, relatively young man, he wrote the Institutes of Christian Religion. And this is, Sam mentioned this in his Calvinism class. This is the document that basically laid out, in fact, it was probably one of the most complete, if not complete, documents that was ever put together up to that point in time on the religious beliefs of the theology of the Reformation. He would go on to meet a fellow named Farrell, who was a preacher in Geneva, and Farrell convinced Calvin to come to Geneva, and so Calvin worked hard to convert people in Geneva to this theology, Calvinism, as we know it, and for a couple of years, well, the local town council wouldn't go along with it, so they kicked him out of town. But the people did, and so there was such an uproar, within a couple of years they had to bring him back. And not only did they bring him back, but like Zwingli, they made him effectively dictator of the city. He was actually a member of the city council, but he didn't have any special position on the council. It was by his influence through the church and his theology and the influence on the people that they just couldn't argue with him if they wanted to. So he basically acted as dictator. And the guy was ruthless. You kind of associate Calvin with, his theology, but he was, as far as his behavior, he was ruthless. And he ended up setting up rules that people had to follow. He had a spy network. But the only people allowed out after curfew were spies. And so if you were out after curfew, and weren't a spy, you were in trouble. They would excommunicate anybody who didn't follow Calvin's theology, much like the Catholics. And the secular arm would end up carrying out the excommunication, and that meant running you out of town, or you were killed. And in the case of his period of time, when he was in control, the data I had, there were 57 executions and 76 banishments because of what he called heresy, which really meant he didn't follow his theology. And then the life of people just very regulated. The inns had to report people that committed any offense in terms of things that went on in the inns, like swearing. They'd be in trouble for that. The inns had to keep a Bible handy. And so there were just these kinds of things he put in place that is part of his rule. And I guess he was A, autocratic, and B, ruthless. That's the only two ways I know to describe him. He followed in many ways, of course, what the path Zwingli had set in terms of his beliefs. And in particular, the idea that the Bible should be your guide. I won't say beyond that. There were other things he didn't agree with. In his case, while the Bible should be the guide, his belief was that only the elect could interpret the Bible. So if you weren't one of the elect, you had no chance, therefore, and this is consistent with Tulip, if you weren't one of the elect, you had no chance of understanding the Bible because God hadn't prepared to give you the insight to let you understand it. He also taught that the purpose of life is to glorify God and not seek pleasure. And his extrapolation of that was you weren't to have any kind of luxury associated with you as far as your lifestyle goes. We know the teaching. Hey, how about we do a review? What was Calvinism? What's Tulip?
Total depravity.
Total depravity.
They like to meet it, man.
What was it? I'm deaf. I know Herb didn't hear you. What'd you say?
Unconditional
election. What's the other one? What's the next one?
Limited.
Atonement, okay. What's the next?
Irresistible grace.
Irresistible grace. And what's the final? Preservation of the saints. Okay, there's two of them. Want to teach it again? And of course, as we know, Calvin was very much influenced by and followed on the teachings of Augustine. One of the things Augustine said is God, there was a difference here. God permits people to be damned. In the case of Calvin, he takes a position that Christ decrees certain people to be damned. In other words, he's made the selection ahead of time. He's predestined. And there's a fixed number of people who will be saved, the elect. And God has ordained that from all eternity. So you had Calvin passed away. And in his place, a fellow named Beza, Theodore, I guess actually Beza, Theodore Beza took over for him. But he was not the same dynamic leader that Calvin was. But nonetheless, the theology would continue. I'll just bring this in. It's not in your lesson here. We'll hit it a little bit later on, and you've seen this. Sam talked about it. There was another movement that was against the theology of Calvin, and that was Arminianism. And it came about after Calvin was actually dead. It came about in the early 1600s. And their teachings was basically that God was sovereign, but man had a free will, and those were compatible. And so they would teach that election and condemnation on the day of judgment was conditioned by rational faith or non-faith. Atonement was effective only for the man of faith. Unaided by the Holy Spirit, no person was able to respond to God's will, so they still had the Holy Spirit doing something. Grace is not irresistible, or positive said, grace is resistible, I suppose. And you're able to resist sin, but you're not beyond the possibility of falling away. So this was the counter to Calvinism, and of course the two things were mentioned by Sam. One, this was put in a document, these teachings were put in a document called the Remonstrance, and they went before the Synod, I guess, of Dort, right? And the Synod of Dort condemned their position, their theology, and upheld Calvinism. So that's the Reformation in a nutshell that went on between the control of the Catholic Church and the coming of age coming into being of the various Reformed or Protestant theologies in that part of the country. We jump across the channel. You got another one, and that is, and all these are going on. Like I said, these three are going on parallel and simultaneously, same periods. And it isn't one's leading the other. As they get far enough down the road, they recognize there are people that share their views, and so they work together, or at least get exposed to each other's teachings. Tyndale in the English Reformation. Tyndale was a guy who was involved early in the English Reformation. He was both a reformer and also a Bible translator. He was an Oxford graduate and studied scriptures in Greek and Hebrew. And one of his claims to fame, when he was 30. He decided he was going to translate the Bible from the original languages to English. And this would be the first Bible, I believe, from the original Greek and Hebrew into the English language. And so he went to London looking to work on his translation, and by 1525, and I'm sorry, 50, yeah, 1525, he had translated the New Testament. He actually had to, he got ran out of England because England still had the Catholic Church was in control in England. And so he got run out of England and went to Germany, and that's where he finished up his work. And so he did the New Testament in 1525. They ended up producing about 15,000 copies over the next 5 years, sent them across the channel, and a lot of those, of course, were destroyed because the Catholics weren't allowed to teach. The laity were not allowed to have the Bible. And so they destroyed as many as they could, but they still made their way around. Tyndale did not return to England because he was an outlaw in their view, but he continued to work abroad, and he made revisions to his translations, and ended up his final revision was in 1535, so 10 years later. He began work on the translation of the Old Testament, but he died before he finished that. And there was a fellow, another name you may have heard of, Miles Coverdale, who finished up the did the entire Bible in English, but he rested a lot of his translation on the Tyndale's translation, plus his own knowledge of the Hebrew and other Hebrew writings. Tyndale himself was put into prison and ended up being condemned to death, and they strangled him and burned him at the stake. Just wanted to make sure he was dead in 1536. You may have heard this somewhere in the past. He's the guy that supposedly prayed at his death as he was burning, "Lord, open the eyes, open the King of England's eyes." And so that was his desire to get the Word of God in the people's hands in their common language, and to be able to study it and use it and live by it rather than live under the Catholic system.
Wally,
yes, sir.
Talk to us about the Tyndale translation. How accurate it is? Is it instrumental to the King James or what?
You have my notes.
But you can actually buy one of the original Tyndale Bibles. It costs $7 million. You can get trained.
Oh, they're around. Yeah,
yeah,
they're available.
They're very expensive.
Sure,
but you can buy a copy of it for about $35 on his original translation.
There is one also, isn't it, Huntington?
I don't remember.
In the English,
I don't remember.
I think. The Tyndale Bible is there also.
Yeah. While we're on that, I've got a little yellow sheet here that's going to help me do that, but I'll jump to it now. What we know is the King James Bible. We're going to go all the way through talking about Elizabeth as far as the kings and queens during the Reformation and how the Reformation was taking place, leapfrogging. Elizabeth did not have any children. And so the person that ended up being King of England was actually a cousin. It was James VI that was in the King of Scotland. And when she had no issue, they brought him in. He became the King of King James I, as King of England. And he figured that out. He was King James VI. Now he's King James I. So he's flexible. So anyway, the King James Version itself was written over a period of about 7 years, 1604, 1611. It's really a remarkable work. I mean, it's just absolutely a remarkable piece of work. Because you had 54 men that were pulled together. And I've been talking about the theology that was in place at the time, and yet these men are going to end up producing what you have can you may be using. I don't know if anybody in here is, but I've used it when I was growing up. King James Bible, still a good Bible. But these 54 men split up six companies. They divided up the work, and they'd go through as a lot of these committees would do. They based their works on Tyndale. Tyndale led to the actually has a lineage of going to the Matthew Bible, the Great Bible and the Bishop's Bible. And so that's Tyndale's lineage at this point in time. So those were things were going along where the King James decided we needed a Bible of our own, and as far as this country goes. And there were like this data, there were like 4,500 documents used. There have been a number of revisions. I think 1769 is probably the one that's generally in use today by people. In 76, the New King James came on the scene because of upgrading the English. But it worked off the same basic textual documents. There were four, at this time, there were four major Greek Greek manuscripts, is what I'm trying to say. The Vatican, the Sinaitic, the Alexandrian, and the Ephraim. And these were all 300, 400 documents. 300 AD, 400 AD. And those were the Greek texts that they had. I say Greek. Those were the texts they had available to them. They were Greek texts. I said that right. The product of this, then, as I say, has just stood the test of time. Now, what's happened? You get New American Standard is the main one that I think of, and it's got some predecessors that led up to it. It incorporates not only the work of King James translators had available to them, the works, manuscripts and the like, but so much more was added, found, over from 1600 to basically 1900 in terms of documents that they're based on. That translation's based on a different textual foundation. And yet you compare the two of them and there are few differences. There are differences, but there are a few differences. And they're generally always tied to the textual differences that they're based on. So anyway, that's a side trip.
Can you say Tyndale? He was one guy. He had King James 54, 50+. So the Tyndale is a pretty active version, and would that say a lot about him? Remarkable work. Was just
smart guy. Wow. I mean, he's 30 years old when he started this.
Yeah, and then King James is similar. Pitch war scholar. Yeah. So it was a remarkable feat what he did. Not in terms of time, but in media color.
Yeah. You if you ever read the history of people, I don't. I just see those blurbs about people like these circuit preachers that used to go around. Spurgeon's another one. It's just phenomenal. I mean, you think about them sitting in a room someplace with a candle or a lantern. This is how they had to read, and yet they wrote volumes. They read volumes. And it's just
nothing better to do.
Maybe we don't either. We just choose to do other things. I don't know. Yeah, I've often wondered about that. But in any event, that's the side trip on the King James Version. I didn't ask Rocky to ask that question. That's why I had information. After Tyndale, you've got... we're going to switch off a little bit because we get into the kings and queens, ruling lineage and the influence they had in terms of the Reformation that was going on in their country. Let's back up. There was a Henry the Seventh, and he had two sons, Arthur and Henry. Arthur was the oldest, and he married this person called Catherine of Aragon, which is in France. I'm pretty sure it's in France. And anyway, it was Spain. Aragon's in Spain. But Henry the Seventh had his son marry Catherine. Catherine brought with her a very large dowry from Spain. So when the boy, that is Arthur, who had married her, died prematurely, and they hadn't actually consummated the marriage, Henry VII went to the Catholic Church to see if he could get Catherine to be married to his son Henry, who would become Henry VIII. I hope I didn't lose you on all that. And the Pope Julius at the time investigated and said yes, he could. So you've got the brother marrying his older brother's wife.
After he died?
After the older brother had died, Arthur had died. Henry VIII was still very much younger than Catherine. But they married. They lived 18 years together. They had some great number of kids, 7 kids. But only one of them lived to adulthood, and that was Mary. And when Mary was to be married, the proposed marriage to a French prince was objected to because of this marriage to Catherine that had occurred by Henry. So Henry didn't want to lose the dowry, this big dowry that had come over. And so what they decided to do is he went back to the Pope at the time, who was Clement, and said, look, this Julius ruled this wrong. This shouldn't have been allowed. I should be now allowed to be divorced from Catherine. It's really an illegitimate marriage. And Clement said, no, it was a good marriage. You're not allowed to divorce Catherine. Well, he didn't like that. So he just broke off with the Pope. He set himself up as the leader of the church in England. And he became head of the Church of England as a result of that. Now, this is Henry VIII, okay? And at the time, a lot of the priests said, oh, it's okay. It won't last very long. So they went along with him. He appointed a guy by the name of Cranmer, who was his advocate in this attempt to get a divorce. And Cranmer became the Archbishop of Canterbury. And as soon as he became the Archbishop of Canterbury, then he said, okay, Henry VIII, you can divorce this woman and be married to the one he was in love with, which was, what was her name? None of it really matters.
Was it Anne Boleyn?
Yeah, I think it's Anne Boleyn. I think that's the one. Yeah, Anne Boleyn. And he'd already married her 3 months earlier anyway. So Henry got, as a result of all this, Henry gets kicked out of the Catholic Church, as you might expect. Henry was made supreme head of the Church of England, and the Parliament approved the succession of Anne's children and Boleyn's children to the throne and required everybody to take an oath to Anne's children. And so you have that situation. And this break with the Pope. Well, what would happen? They ended up putting out a document, 10 articles, which set the basis for the Church of England. And something woke Henry up to the fact that this wasn't going to work. This break with the papacy wasn't going to work like he thought it was. And so he revoked the 10 articles because they were, as you might expect, counter to some of the teaching of the Catholic Church. And went to 6 articles. And within the 6 articles, transubstantiation and clerical celibacy were included. Well, that created a problem because up to that point in time, as he set up the Church of England, the priests didn't have to be, and clerical people did not have to be celibate. So now all of a sudden, you've got the Archbishop of Canterbury has to divorce his wife. So here's the guy that got him, got this whole thing going, is Cranmer, and now he's got to divorce his wife, as well as any of the other churchmen that had wives. And when it was all said and done, a lot of the reformers saw this is what's going to work, and they just left England. And in essence, although it was a break from, in theory, a break from the Catholic Church, in fact, they continued to have a relationship with the Catholic Church throughout this period. He had, Henry VIII, go on and have a son, Edward, who was 9 years old when he came to the throne. So he was too young to rule. And he ended up having his uncle rule through his uncle. His uncle had very definite Protestant ideas. And so as a result of that, the English Church, Church of England, got directed away from the Catholic Church into Protestantism in a big way. And the Duke of Somerset was made, quote, Lord Protector and Encourager by Cranmer. And so they basically, by royal injunction, you were a Catholic or you were a Church of England, or a Catholic Church of England, however you want to describe it, you're now a Church of England Protestant by edict. And so that was the way they managed that. And they had a prayer book that was issued. Which was basically an attempt to compromise between Catholics and Protestants. But then it got kicked out, and it was replaced by another one, which was much more Protestant in its nature. And these prayer books, by the way, we'll talk about the one I've given you a copy of, or pieces of it. They're basically questions. It's almost like rote liturgy. You know, question and answer kinds of things, or statements that you make in the course of the various aspects of religious life. You'll see that when you look at those. So you have Mary. So this is Edward in place, and you had the reformers coming back, by the way, during this period of time. Well, Edward dies, and Mary, who is the daughter of Catherine of Aragon, the only adult. The only person who lived adulthood out of the marriage of King of Henry and Catherine, she came on the throne. Well, she was Catholic. She was raised Catholic, and she believed in the Catholic. And it was by that time, the idea was who was ruling on the throne, whatever their religion was, that's the religion you took. So you had all these people under Edward that were thinking they were Protestants, and now all of a sudden you become Catholic because the king's going, or in this case, the queen becomes Catholic. And so she required that to happen. And she sent word to the Pope, and the Pope sent delegates back to England to bring them back in fully to their fold. And when they did that, the indulgences got this whole thing started. But there was another aspect. Why did the secular rulers not like the Church of England? The Catholic Church.
Took their land.
Took their land, took their money. And so the Catholic Church said, okay, England, you can come back in, but give us all the land that you took back from, all the property you took away from us when you split. Well, that wasn't going to go down too well. And so they actually backed off of that. And ended up that they did not have to return the property, and they kind of looked at it as a cost of missionary work and making that happen. So you had all these Protestant ideas that came under Edward, and now you turn that around with Mary, but the people didn't particularly care for that, and so you had a lot of people could not return back to the Pope and live under that system. And so you have during this Mary's reign, you can imagine what happens. These people are now heretics. And there were 288 people martyred because of this. Hence, we get our term. I know who Mary's called?
Bloody Mary.
Bloody Mary. And this is why she's called Bloody Mary. And she would pass, and her daughter, who was Elizabeth, would take over. And in Elizabeth's case, we've had a Catholic and a Protestant, or Protestant and a Catholic. Well, in Elizabeth's case, she really wanted to maintain peace. And so she was Catholic at heart, but she allowed Protestants to exist in a legal framework. And so it was not illegal to be a Protestant. Yeah,
Elizabeth, I thought this was Anne Boleyn's book.
She is, what did I say?
Catherine.
I said Catholic.
Oh, okay.
I thought.
Oh, okay. She was Protestant.
She was Anne Boleyn's daughter. Mm-hmm. She was also she was actually she wanted to satisfy everybody. Say she's Catholic. She had leanings to Catholicism. She wanted to please everybody, Catholic and Protestant, and in terms of her rule. And so she had a crucifix, burned candles, had a private mass, but she allowed the Protestants to exist legally. Okay? She was fairly well trained herself, and she later actually ended up being excommunicated from the Pope because she took on the Calvinistic views. So she would change her views as time goes on. And historians really say, in point of fact, it's hard to tell what she was. Depends on the day of the week, I think, as far as what she was.
So she was a politician.
She was very good. That's right. And in 1559, there was something called the Act of Supremacy. And Elizabeth took the title of the Supreme Governor of Things Ecclesiastical and Spiritual as well as Temporal. But she wasn't able to remit sins. The reason I say it, bring that up, to this day, the Queen of Elizabeth II, Queen of England, or whoever the ruling authority is the supreme governor of things ecclesiastical, etc., etc. So this law is still in play as far as the King of England goes, King and Queen of England.
That is very interesting in history. We talked about the Swiss reformers, German reformers, Luther and Calvin and Zwingli. They all felt like the state should have a hand in dictating and making these rules so that people could follow. And here in England, you see this kind of thing carrying out where the king takes it into his own hands, where it's like a political party play kind of thing. But that's what they were doing. They were enacting all these rules on the people, and the people just had to follow whatever the king was.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that as this evolves, you have people that start saying, it's not a good idea for the Catholic Church to rule over, or for, this other Church of England or any other group that's involved with the state to rule over us. So,
hence the Anabaptist.
Segue for me.
So you have the Anabaptists come on the scene. It's just another group in the midst of these reformations that have a different, starting to develop a different aspect. And the Anabaptists, they get their name from the fact that in their studies they came to the conclusion that it was being baptized as an infant had no meaning whatsoever. Only being baptized as a believer had any meaning relative to your salvation. And so as a result of that, they would be baptized again. And they ended up being persecuted by the Catholics and the Lutherans and the Zwingli followers. In some ways, they were very close to the New Testament. In some ways, they were very radical. In general, they had views out of the scriptures that you and I would have, and that is that the church was composed of believers only. They rejected infant baptism. They put church membership on the basis of personal faith and conscious submission to Christ and baptism. So that's kind of their basic teaching